Live from Burbank, California, it's built atop a quicksand of shoddy scholarship and recycled conspiracies. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's having a crushing impact on the planet. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim Earle. Thank you, people. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. And, of course, you lurking conservatives with your diminishing sense of purpose and ideology. I can't even see how any of you can be confident of anything anymore. I mean, I don't even know. I don't have any conservative friends that I know of, though I'm starting to suspect. I'm starting to suspect people that you think are at least liberal a little bit, that they're not so political at all. That's the one thing I'm starting to realize lately. The amount of effort and the amount of focus and the amount of concentration required to keep abreast of the political situation and honestly know how you feel as an individual and what you feel about in terms of issues. I mean, I'm literally, when I go to comedy clubs or when I talk to the people that that you and I know, I'm not talking about the people that blog on our show, but I'm talking about regular old people that you know in show business.
Yeah.
They seem to me, Jim, to be, more than anything else, completely self-centered, completely self-involved, completely devoid of any real sense of what is political, what the issues are, and what it means to be informed politically, that they just sort of pay lip service to being like, oh, yeah, I mean, I hate Bush. I hate him, Bush. I hate that guy. And I think all that stuff is bad.
Well, isn't show business political in and of itself? I mean, people are trained to be political in show business and not offend, even though they may come off as, you know, with their characters of being edgy or, you know, and
oh,
well,
you're saying, okay, you're saying that socially political and diplomatic by nature in order to grease their way through the industry. Yeah, I understand that. I think that any hierarchy, any social interaction, almost anything that you apply any forethought to before you walk into a situation with other individuals or communicating with other people is innately political. That if you're not just sort of pummeling through life, you know, expecting people to react to you, then you're a political being. But I know what you're saying, that there's an assumption here that everybody in show business or people that are in show business are to the left. But the bottom line is I doubt the commitment of certainly some people with money in this business and certainly people who are just regular old people. I just don't think they think about it. And that's clear to me.
They're thinking about themselves, like many political comics who label themselves as political comics.
Who are they?
Aren't really political because they, you know, they come onto the audience and go, hey, you, those Democrats, but you Republicans, I'm not letting you off too easy. Well, what the hell do you believe in? I mean, you must have an opinion on one way or another. You can't. It's not equal.
That's,
you know?
True. That's true. That people don't. I think the big fear is, and I understand this fear, is the fear of appearing strident, is the fear of taking a hard line, partisan view and alienating people. Because I think that most people think leftist spokespeople or left-leaning pundits are shrill. And for some reason, right-leaning pundits are easier to criticize or emulate because they're so narrow-minded. And it's a lot easier to take shots at them. But if you are acting from a point of progressive politics as a comic, you know, where's the tension to it? Where are you not preaching? There's always that thing. Even with the smartest, most hippest people, it's sort of like, he's a little preachy. They're afraid to take an opinion because they are smug, they are condescending, and they allude to being or thinking a certain way. But I don't think the goods are there. Am I being too esoteric?
No. I mean, let's look at it from both sides here.
Yeah.
Buddy Epson, really, really right-wing conservative. The woman who played Mrs. Hathaway, Miss Hathaway,
mm-hmm.
really left, liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have this, you know, big-headed, affable guy who's, you know, like everybody's uncle or father or grandfather, you know?
Yeah.
He's got this a better image than the kind of shrill, you know, Miss Hathaway.
Sure. So this is, of course, a lot of people don't realize that this is a very popular and it's a great model to look at politics, the Beverly Hillbillies, and it's not applied as often as it should be. A lot of people, you know, try to draw examples from modern life or from examples within the last 30 years of television. But
mm-hmm.
but Jim is going back in the history of television to prove a point that I don't think there is a better way to prove that necessarily.
Ellie Mae, the environmentalist who becomes disillusioned with her path in life and becomes born again.
Yeah. Right, right. Born, and Max Baer, of course, just, you know, just wants to be a movie star.
Right.
Yeah, and that's who we're talking about, is that who really knows what Max Baer was thinking? That's the point I'm trying to make here.
I don't know, man.
Jethro is a pivotal character. He's ever present in all those Beverly Hills episodes, but we never know where he stands. We just know that he wants to be a movie star, correct?
Correct.
That he wants to be part of the system no matter what. So when it comes right down to it, I think the question we're trying to ask is, what is Jethro really thinking? And that's what I'm trying to find out about my friends, about my peers, because I know how much energy it takes to do this. Hold on. Let me set up this show, and we're going to continue this. Today we have Eric Schlosser, author of one of the greatest books ever written in the last 10 years, certainly. In terms of journalism and revelations, I think Fast Food Nation was a great book on so many levels. He's come out with another book. It's called Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food. It's really geared towards younger people. And I see, that's another this when I'm doing the research on this guy, on Schlosser, who I've talked to many times about the meat industry and about fast food.
Mm-hmm.
The question really comes down to, he's got this book now that's going to appeal to young people. Now, when you got young people, those are people that want to eat McDonald's. It's part of their social fabric of who they are. When I was growing up, we'd meet at the McDonald's. We'd meet at the Wendy's. We'd go there for lunch. Each high school had its own McDonald's that we hung out at. I don't think McDonald's planned it that way, but that was the nature of it. Now, I'm wondering if, even with the facts that he presents to young people in this new book, are people going to be like, oh, come on, dude. It's Mickey D's, man.
Probably.
It's Mickey D's.
I would think so.
Like, have you ever been in the car with a bunch of high school kids and you're going to lunch? Like, we could drive when I was in high school because you got your license when you're like 15 in New Mexico. And once you got your car, man, you'd be heading off campus for lunch, you know? So if I was the guy in there that's saying, hey, let's go to Tofu Charlie's. I mean, you think they're going to turn away from McDonald's to go to Tofu Charlie's? I don't think so. Like, can we go someplace we get a nice salad with some seitan? I don't know if it's going to happen, dude. And I don't know how long those friends are going to tolerate me. It's the same issue I'm talking about. This is exactly the same issue we're starting with here, Jim. That guy in that car at 15 years old who wants to do the right thing for his health and for the world by eating things that don't tax the environment or kill him, is the guy they're going to be like, what a pussy.
Yeah.
A wuss, man. Hey, why don't we just drop you off at Hippie Land?
See, they're counting on no 15-year-old wants to do anything good for their body or their health or anything like that. That's why they're easy to send off to war.
But on another level, when I was 15, if I had been told this stuff, if you are the kind of person that I think there is enough young people now that are concerned about enough things, and there's a way that this stuff could be cool. But the same thing we're talking about before, the same thing we're talking about with adults who are the ones that say, you're awfully preachy. It's like, well, at least I have an opinion. Where the hell do you stand? Come on, dude. Look at, I make references to three or four cartoon characters in my act. And I also, I know some esoteric things, but they don't have an opinion politically because they're afraid to put themselves out like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a form of peer pressure and a fear of lack of acceptance and a fear of appearing shrill. You know, and I realized this the other night on stage, and I've been talking about this, that there's a certain amount of things that, you know, I'm angry about. And there's a certain amount of things that I have to look at and investigate every day to find what fuels the anger, to find what informs that anger. It's not enough just to condescend and say, yeah, of course, I'm against that, man. I mean, at some point you got to speak the hell up. Am I right?
I agree.
All right.
Let me tell you a story about McDonald's.
OK.
But. 20 years ago, my college friend and I decided to visit every McDonald's within a 100-mile radius in one day.
How'd that go?
And, the stipulation was that we would have to purchase something and eat it.
Yeah.
Consume it there before we moved on to the next McDonald's.
Uh-huh. And how'd that go? How many did you hit?
We hit about 35.
Was this the last? Was this the end of the meat thing for you?
No. I was still heavy in the meat. You know, Wendy's I'd eat almost every day.
Yeah, me too. When I was in high school, when Wendy's came around, because we were young enough when it first appeared.
Yeah, the big Frosty and those French fries.
Oh, the Frosty and the French and the square hamburgers.
Yeah, and the
dripping with goop.
And that prepubescent, red-haired girl that kind of, what's going
on
there?
Yeah, heard. Everyone, there was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. The chili. I never ate the chili. And remember when Wendy's put salad bars in, and then we all took that turn to the left, and we were like, I think I'm going to get a salad today, man. But it was okay because the other guys could get their burgers.
Yeah.
Remember when the chicken sandwich came out?
I was never a big fan of the chicken sandwich.
Really? The fried chicken sandwich?
Just I was a big burger guy. All meat, 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 meat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with you, man. And I think that when we talk to Eric Schlosser, we have both sides of it. Because I know he, for a fact, likes McDonald's fries. But you read that book, it'll blow your mind. Richard Grant also, great actor. One of the great. Did you ever see How to Get Ahead in Advertising? Where the head grows out of his shoulder?
God, no, I didn't.
Oh, you would remember it. And Whitnell, now he's got a pretty big cult following. He's also been in a couple Altman movies. He's worked a lot, but now he's directed a film called Wawa, and I believe it's an autobiographical film about his family when they were stationed in Swaziland. I had no idea that the British Empire even went that far, that they had outposts there. But it was towards the last sort of the dying gasps of the British Empire's, you know, power or extension into Swaziland, and that's where the movie takes place. I'm looking forward to talking to him. Tom Cruise's film, Mission Impossible 3, disappointed at the box office at $48 million. It's disappointing opening weekend at $48 million.
Well, disappointing for the Scientologists. We need more money.
It took $10 million off. It took $10 million. It was not expectations of the second one. So they're wondering if it's because of the image that he's created for himself now with the Scientology and the speaking out and the complete insanity of who he is at this point in history, whether that diminished the box office returns. Well, guess what? He's calling us. We're going to get him on the phone
Tom
again.
Tom Cruise?
We're going to get him on the phone again. This is the second time Tom Cruise has been on this show. I guess he feels like he can really open up here because, you know, doesn't think anyone's listening. So stay with us.
What?
Tom Cruise. Huh? Next?
Huh?
Tom Cruise? Yeah. Eric Schlosser later. Richard Grant. Big show.
And now, conservatives keep driving his approval levels down. Mark Maron.
Horrendous. 31%, that's the new USA Gallup on Bush. 31% approval rating. 65% disapproval. 65% disapproval.
You know, it's going to get so bad that I'm going to start liking him.
That's almost everybody. Folks, we don't want you to be caught uninformed or caught off guard. A lot happened in the news today, so let's do the Mark Maron Show's short order news. The leader of Iran has written to President Bush proposing new solutions to their differences in the first letter from an Iranian head of state to an American president in 27 years. This action may be enough to break the deadlock between the U.S. and Iran and perhaps forestalling Armageddon for as much as a week. The Senate is expressing serious concerns about General Michael Hayden, President Bush's expected choice to replace Porter Goss as head of the CIA. A Bush spokesman tried to ease concerns by saying, quote, if we had the military in charge of the CIA going into Iraq, you wouldn't have even known we were exaggerating the threat of WMDs. And if you didn't know that, you would trust us. I ask you, wouldn't you be happier trusting your government? End quote. China has manufactured its first personal robot that can provide services at home and, among other skills, log on to the internet and tell its owners the news and weather. Liang Lang is the name of the robot, is capable of so many human-like activities. She's being sold to Chinese consumers as the daughter you'll never have to drown. That's the short order news for today. As I said before the break, Jim, Mission Impossible disappointed at the box office. In terms of business standards, bringing in about $48 million, they're expecting about 60 or 58 to 60 million. And to address this situation for the second time in our show's history here, Tom Cruise is on the phone. How are you, Tom?
Hey, Mark. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. So, what do you think? It seemed like your movie opened a little weaker than people expected.
Well, Mark, I'm a little confused. Since when was coming in number one at the box office considered a bad thing? Okay.
Yeah, but it earned $10 million less than the last Mission Impossible.
Well, I like to think of it as that I defied expectations.
How's that?
Well, they were expecting it to make a lot more money, but I was just like, you know, switching it around on them.
All right, yeah, okay, Mr. Cruise, that's one way to spin it. So maybe the lesson here to be learned is that you don't really need publicity stunts, my friend.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, Mark, I don't know if you heard about this.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that Kate and I had a beautiful baby girl, Suri.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But one thing I just want to put out there that I don't know if people are really aware of it yet.
Yeah.
This baby has superpowers.
What? Oh, come on, Tom. I mean, you know, I think it's time.
Through time. Her name's actually an acronym.
Uh-huh.
It stands for Super Ultra Rhino Attacker.
Uh-huh.
She attacks when rhinos are, creating evil. She attacks them with light from her eyes.
Hey, Tom, don't you think it's like high time that you stop doing the crazy crap and maybe, you know, start thinking that maybe it's time to repair the image? I mean, it's just not true that your kid can do that. I mean, let's be honest.
All right, you know what? I'm going to be totally real with you right
okay,
now,
Mark. All right, cool.
I'm going to be totally sincere with you and your audience because this is the platform to do it.
Right.
I'm in love.
With Katie? That's great. No.
That's yesterday's garbage. I'm in love for the first real time in my life, and it feels so amazing. I don't know if you've heard of Natalie Portman.
Sure, the actress, of course.
Yes, we are pretty crazy about each other. I just proposed to her yesterday on the wing of Air Force One, and I am delighted to report that she said, "See."
Oh, my God. Come on, Tom. Come on now. You're talking crap. I mean, you don't have to keep getting engaged and having kids to attract people. You just got to stop talking about Scientology.
Is that it? God, what do people want? I don't know what to do. You know what I mean? It's just like I just want to do my thing. Like, it used to be so much easier than this.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
what do people want from me, Mark? I just don't get it.
They just want you to stop being so weird.
Well, I'm just being the person I know how to be, okay?
All right.
And as far as that drowning daughters thing, I don't think that's cool, man.
Yeah, well, look, I don't think it's cool that you start talking about Natalie Portman out of nowhere and that you say...
I am in love!
All right. Well, Tom, thank you very much. You're out of your mind.
All right, thank you, buddy.
Yeah, okay, you take care.
You too.
Oh, man.
Well, man, he's in love again.
I know, Natalie Portman. Who the hell knew that?
Man.
I don't know. In all honesty, I saw people waiting online to go see Mission Impossible, and there's no way I was going to see it, but... there was a moment where I'm like, do I have to see it? Should I go see it?
I'm kind of interested in seeing it myself.
So. You are?
Yeah, it's very escapist. Why not? What the hell?
I don't know, man. I'm
not going to be thinking of him, you know, eating afterbirth or whatever.
Yeah. Well, look, during this show, at some point in time, maybe in the next segment, we are going to be talking about the appointment of this General Hayden to the CIA. We are going to be talking about the reality of Dusty Fogo, the third in charge over at the CIA, under Porter Goss, who, of course, left. Dusty Fogo was implicated in this hooker gate in these poker games hosted by that guy Wilkes, the military contractor. Fogo has said he's going to retire early, and Negroponte is putting his guy in. So is this all becoming one big agency run under the Pentagon? Is the fight between Negroponte and Rumsfeld real? Is the CIA completely gutted because of political reasons that this administration thinks that it operates against them? These are questions I have no idea the answers to, but I'm going to talk about them anyway. Stay with us.
And now he's got the brain of a lesbian, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. I guess, yeah, okay. All right, I've got the brain of a lesbian. So, Goss is out. Porter Goss is out. That's last week's news. Now, the guy who's going in is this guy who was the Deputy Director of National Intelligence under John Death Squad Negroponte, of course. This guy, General Michael V. Hayden. Now, from what I can glean, this means the end of the CIA as we know it, the end of the CIA as an independent intelligence bureau, the end of the CIA being able to provide information that is relatively unbiased, despite however you think they go about getting that information. But the virtue of the CIA was that it was not a partisan organization. Now what we have is a military guy going in there from the department of, well, it's not even a department, a guy who worked under Negroponte at the National Intelligence, it's not an agency per se, but he's the Deputy Director of National Intelligence. Was this idea to create this entity, to create this guy who would oversee all 16 branches of information gathering of intelligence agencies, including the FBI and the Department of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. So a lot of people are starting to think that the military is completely taking over all of the intelligence gathering, all of these these information agencies. And what does that mean? Apparently, according to Larry Johnson, who was an ex-CIA guy, he was on Ed Schultz earlier today. He used to be a guest on my show regularly. I've been reading about it. He thinks that what's going to happen is that the quality of intelligence that's going to be found and going to be used to protect this country, to stay abreast of what is going on in the world, will be completely compromised. That there may be a bigger bureaucracy being created, that the idea of the National Intelligence Czar was to oversee all these things, was to bring communications to a better place, but this could break it apart even more. And on another level, on the bottom line, is that there's more scandal. Is that, you know, Porter Goss, made a mess of it. When Porter Goss got in there after George Tenet, he did not defend the agency. He did not say that the administration used the agency to justify its war by cherry-picking intelligence. There was a tremendous amount of resistance within the CIA from people who worked there for years in terms of how it was being treated. And Porter Goss did not stand up for them. His leadership faltered, and a lot of those guys left. A lot of the guys that defined what the CIA was and its effectiveness left. And some people are assuming that Bush and Cheney had it out for the CIA from the beginning because they felt that it was operating against them. And that was the idea of the CIA, was to be a nonpartisan entity. Despite that they've been up to dirty things in the past and they've been bad guys in terms of if you're going to talk about progressive issues and the treatment of people and torture and all that, that is heinous. But the bottom line is what's happening now, I think, is even more heinous, that the military will be able to facilitate whatever the hell it wants through whatever intelligence agency it wants. And this guy who's going in is an ass. He is an ass. He is a guy who is unabashedly supporting of domestic spying. He's a guy that, in a speech on January 23rd, this guy, General Hayden, boasted that he was knowledgeable of the Fourth Amendment. Guarantees our protections against, unlawful search and seizure. And he did not know what the Fourth Amendment really was. He did not realize that you needed probable cause to do these things. These are people that are against the basic rights that the Constitution affords us. And I think that his appointment to the CIA is going to only amplify that.
I think it went one level beyond that. I think he knew exactly what the Fourth Amendment was. He just wanted to interpret it in his own way to rationalize and justify spying.
I don't think
he called it a reasonable search and seizure. You have to have probable cause. That's what the Fourth Amendment is.
Right, but he said he did not, when they asked him, he was bluntly asked, and I heard this on Ed Schultz today, but he was asked. He said he was being questioned by a Knight Ridder reporter named Jonathan Landy, and he was being questioned, and Landy said if the amendment contained the phrase probable cause, and Hayden said no. So despite whatever level it is, no one wants to look stupid. I mean, it's right there on the paper.
Well, he's following the Bush line of lying and about it something and then repeating it and repeating it.
Assuming that somehow or another that amendment would just disappear.
If you look
dissolve.
Competent while you're lying, then that's as good as truth.
To some people. Well, I the whole thing frightens me, but I think that in the broader picture, what it represents to me is that Porter Goss is out. And that might have been a political thing. It might have been his connection to this Hookergate, his underling, the third in command over there. This guy Fogo, Dusty Fogo, has been implicated in the Wilkes party, the Duke Cunningham poker prostitutes party. He's supposedly searching for early retirement, which means the CIA will be completely gutted and integrated under Negroponte's rule and under the Pentagon's command on some level, because it is a general. So that means we have no supposedly nonpartisan intelligence entity out there, which means that the military, in collusion with whatever administration is in place, which is going to be this one for another 2 years, can do whatever the hell they want intelligence-wise.
Woo-hoo!
That there is no integrity to any of the intelligence. They don't even have to cherry-pick anymore. They're going to operate all the agencies. And on top of that, it's all leading up to the fact that if the Democrats botch these midterms, dude, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. This guy, Volz, This guy who is Neil Volz, he was the chief of staff of Representative Bob Ney of Ohio. Ney is under investigation for everything now. He's implicated in a conspiracy with Abramoff, but this guy Volz has admitted that he engaged in a conspiracy to bilk money out of the he was taking bribes, but he was completely aware that that he was involved with Abramoff and funneling this money into trying to change legislation to benefit Abramoff's clients. He's pleaded guilty. And to quote the charge, the purpose of the conspiracy was for defendant Volz and his co-conspirators to unjustly enrich themselves by corruptly receiving while public officials and providing while lobbyists a stream of things of value to influence members of Congress in violation of the law. And now, somehow or another, Bob Ney, his people are saying that he's sticking by his guns. He's not going down. He just won a primary. And I don't know how the hell anyone could vote for this guy, but everybody's lining up against him. You've got, Abramoff's former congressional aides, Michael Scanlon, Tony Rudy, guys who worked for DeLay, and Adam Kadan, have all pleaded guilty to conspiracy, and they've all named Bob Ney, and now this guy, his chief of staff, Volz, has named him as well. The only reason I'm bringing this up, again, and Tom DeLay as well, he's definitely done. Hopefully he'll go to prison, but the indictment's going to stick because just the other day it came out that he directly dealt with Abramoff and not one of Abramoff's front organizations, not one of his advocacy groups. So what I'm saying is with this culture of corruption and this thing still spiraling, it's hitting the CIA that if the Democrats cannot run on that, on top of, domestic spying, the war out of control, costs out of control, energy prices out of control, the environment, any number of things, all we need is 15. I mean, and there's about 40 up for grabs. I mean, if they can't get those back, and I believe they can, but I know that Karl Rove is gearing up, but it seems to be ineffectual because all they're going to really run on is they're dropping the ball on terror. If you give it to the Democrats, they're going to seek to impeach the president, and they're not going to protect our country. If people are that stupid enough, with 65% of this country disapproving of this president, then I don't know. I'm going to lose hope. All right, Jim?
Well,
I'm going to lose hope.
I just hope, people are so... You know, they've been sucker punched since 2000, and with the lies and everything. And it's like, you endure so many instances of corruption and all this crapola going on, then you come to think of it as normal behavior.
Well, it's
normal. Just like the lies, people swallow them too. They hear it often enough. They're sucker punched. It's like they've been hit in the head so many times. It's like, okay, this is the way life is, and this is the way people have to act to be in politics like DeLay does.
But they do know. They have been sucker punched, and I agree with you. But what they are saying is that most people, over 50%, are now saying they'd rather have Democrats running the Congress. They'd rather have Democrats, as the majority.
Well, I hope so. I hope they follow through with that. But
yeah, I know. It just seems like believe me, I swear, and they're kind of keeping this hush-hush now, that some they're pulling back a little of this. Pelosi is pulling back on this, and Dean is pulling back on this. But John Conyers, if they get the control of the House, he is and his committee are going to take these guys to task. If they get control of the House, they can now start a proper investigation, who cares if it's even bipartisan? They can start one with a little teeth that could lead to impeachment, that could at least show that this president broke the law in terms of domestic spying, just to name one of many things. But real investigations could start to take place. And I would think that they could run on that. But the way Rove is going to try and spin it is like, hey, if you let these guys win, they're just going to impeach the president. That's the way they're going to spin it. So they're Dean and Pelosi and some other Democrats are trying to distance themselves a little bit from impeachment proceedings. But the bottom line is they don't even need that. They can just say, look, if we get control of the House, we are going to start a righteous and thorough investigation of how the hell this administration has screwed up this damn country, and just deal and start investigating the freedoms they've taken away from Americans, the compromises that they've forced Americans to deal with, and also the notion of why we went to this war and why it's okay for them to spy on people. So if they just run on that stuff, just as sort of the idea of like, isn't it high time we got to the bottom of this?
So we'll have like 2 years to impeach?
That's plenty of time.
And paralyze the entire presidency.
That's plenty of time. And I don't know what's going to happen in 2008, but in 2006, it seems to me that there is a full menu of things that Democrats could be thinking about. And the bottom line is, just from my own personal experience, conservatives have got nothing. They feel disillusioned. They feel like they've been screwed over by this administration, that this administration doesn't even represent conservative values anymore on a governmental level, on a fiscal level, but even the whack jobs. And also they've got to wake up to the reality that the Republicans, they don't want to overturn Roe v. Wade. There's a contingent within the Republican Party that doesn't want to do that, because if they do that, how are they going to continue to mobilize the religious whack jobs to believe their bag of BS? Do you know what I'm saying? All right. Well, look, let's shift gears. I went to yoga on Saturday. Three times in a week. Can you tell?
It's working, man. I can tell.
Did any of that make sense? Good. Well, look, we're going to get Bruce Cherry in here to pitch us something. That's always...
That won't make sense.
All right. Stay with us.
He's the secret to gas-free beans, Mark Maron.
That's me. Talked to Eric Schlosser in a little while about food. I improvised a Oaxacan squash blossom soup over the weekend, my friend.
Oaxacan?
Yeah, I bought some squash blossoms. I went to the green market after yoga. Look, you ready to go?
Okay.
Folks, as you may know, we recently brought back the most artistically accomplished segment of the show, the fan favorite Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week. Each week, noted humorist Bruce Cherry presents a searing, insightful, and piercingly funny proposal for a recurring bit, all done under the ruse that Bruce was some sort of befuddled idiot. It's called the suspension of disbelief, people. Now please welcome back Bruce Cherry for Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week. Okay, I'm glad. Yes, Bruce. Yes, that was a very nice intro you prepared for us.
Timely.
Mm-hmm. What do you got? Yeah. What do you think?
A lot of controversy over Stephen Colbert's performance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yes.
Perfect introduction to a character I've planned for a while. I'm not going to spoil any surprises. He's a relative of yours, and his name is Yehuda Maron.
Yehuda. Mm-hmm. I take there's going to be some sort of heavy-duty Jewish accent pandering going on here. Is that what's happening?
Pandering, Mark. I think the phrase you're looking for is panning for gold. Let's just go straight to the script, my friend.
Oh, God. All right. Okay, here we go. Folks, with the recent fuss over the White House Correspondents' Dinner, we thought it would be a good time to talk to a man who performed at every White House press dinner from the mid-19th century on. He also happens to be my very own great-great-great uncle. Please welcome the legendary vaudeville comic, Yehuda Maron.
Ah, little Marky.
Oh, yeah.
Last time I saw you, you were crying, you were covered with vomit, and you couldn't stop playing with your little schmeckle.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you were 32, but you were still drinking. Glad to see you've changed, except for the schmeckle thing.
Yeah. Now, Uncle Yehuda, you've been in the entertainment business for a long time.
Look, let me tell you, Sonny, I started out in what were known as minstrel shows.
Oh, I know what those were. You would color your faces with tins of burnt cork.
Exactly. Or as we called it, Schwarzer in a can.
All right, okay. And then you went on to vaudeville. Have you always been a solo performer?
No, not at all. When I started in vaudeville, I was part of the team of Yehuda, Mordecai, Shlomo, and O'Malley.
O'Malley?
Yeah. O'Malley was really named Yitzhak, but we didn't want our name to sound too Jewish.
Oh, yeah, that's good thinking, Uncle Yehuda. So let's talk about the first White House press dinner you did. That was during the Grant administration, right?
Those were golden times for comedy, kid. Can you imagine having a president who's an incompetent alcoholic?
Oh, we should be so lucky. What kind of jokes did you do for Grant?
I don't want to say Ulysses S. Grant is a big drinker, but I think the S stands for Sean. Get it? The Irish drink. What do you call a sober Irishman at a wake? The deceased. Thank you. Hey, is this an audience or a daguerreotype? I wrote that one, you know.
Yeah, I do. Well, that brings up a point. What would you do in the unlikely event, Uncle Yehuda, that a joke failed?
Simple. You tap the microphone and you say, "Is this thing on?" Oh, that's right. They haven't invented electricity yet. Of course, that stopped being funny after they invented electricity.
I can imagine you had to turn over a lot of material through the years, huh?
Tell me about it. I used to do 10 minutes on the Tariff Act of 1883. It would kill. Until the panic of 1893. And not only that, as soon as I gets down a perfect William McKinley impression, some mashugana shoots him. What are you going to do?
Well, what were some of your greatest jokes, Uncle Yehuda?
Okay. Picture this.
Yeah.
The William Howard Taft roast. I gets up and I says, I don't want to say President Taft is fat, but when he lays around the White House, he really lays around the White House.
Oh, my God. Come on, Dave. Uncle Yehuda, that's an old joke.
Not in 1911, it wasn't, Smarty Bants. Here's another. Hey, President Hoover, you suck. Get it? Hoover sucks? It's a vacuum cleaner. Brevity, my boy. Brevity.
Boy, you must have had a lot of success over the years.
Sonny, I got a standing ovation from every single president, except FDR. And he was trying. Believe me, he was trying.
I can imagine the White House press dinner changed a lot in the past century.
Oh, yeah. Except for one thing. Helen Thomas was there every year.
Yeah.
Get it? She's old.
Yeah.
How old is Helen Thomas? People, I went down on her one time, and I think I saw some cave paintings.
Oh, no.
I says, Helen, I think there's somebody spearing a woolly mammoth in your caniche.
Ah, gee, Uncle Yehuda, we're out of time.
Huh? What? It's me. It's me again, Mark.
Yeah.
I'm out of... Was that gold or what? It was a tribute to your heritage.
I felt like I was Carl Reiner.
You felt like you were transported into the land of yuck, yuck, yuck.
Bruce.
Okay, we're going with this one.
I got to be honest with you. We'll see what happens. I don't know if Yehud is the one.
I can do it with an Irish accent.
I don't know, Bruce. Thanks for sharing, but we'll do it next week, and you know, come up with something new. That was, of course, Bruce Cherry. In a few minutes, we are going to talk to Eric Schlosser, who I love that book, man. Fast Food Nation blew my mind. So compelling. It was, you read it, right?
No, I have not read it.
You, of all people, should read that book.
I have not, you know, I haven't had time to read a book in like 5
Jim,
years.
Jim, let me ask you a question.
I'm trying to go back, I'm trying to paint again.
Really?
Yeah, I just bought some painting materials the first time in 20 years. I'm trying to do some things that I haven't done in a long time.
I'm tearing up.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Because I was wondering, you know, I'm asking myself, what the hell does Jim do all day? If he ain't writing the funny.
And doing a lot of this.
Oh, I get it. So you got the easel out and you're gessoing some canvases?
I'm trying to complete a couple of paintings that I started in 1984 in college.
You know what I love about you, Jim?
No. Why'd you tell me?
This is like one thing, two maybe. Is that...
But they're big things, huh?
That your plan B is painting.
It is. And a walnut farm.
Oh, that's great. Because mine's being a musician, which is ridiculous. We have Eric Schlosser in a minute. That's worth hanging out for, so do that.
Now he's powered entirely by corn oil. Mark Maron.
Oh, that's one of the bad oils, too. See this fat right here? It's a little bit of fat?
Yes.
It's the good fat. It's not the bad fat.
Who told you it was a good fat?
It's a good fat, because I don't need any of the bad fat. You want to talk to Eric? Let's do it. Eric Schlosser. What did he say? Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, blew my mind, and was definitely one of the best books of the last 10 years, period. Well, Schlosser got the message through to me about how nasty the fast food industry is on all levels, except maybe fries. Now with his new book, Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food, he's going after the kids who are frequently the victims / happy consumers of fast food product. Nice to talk to you again, Eric Schlosser.
Thanks for having me.
So, on some levels, this is it's just rendered down fast food nation. I guess that's probably a good word for it for young readers. It's reworked to scare the hell out of junior high kids. Am I right?
Well, you know, it's reworked, and then there's also some new material that really take the stories from Fast Food Nation, a lot of the themes, and tell them through the eyes of the kids who are the targets of this industry or the kids who are working in this industry. And and open the reader's eyes about what they're eating.
See, I was thinking about like books like this. Books like this, when I was in high school or junior high, if it had that feeling like, you guys got it, you got to know about this, you got to hear about this, this is crap, that it might really take off. And I just hope that you don't come up against that wall of denial and chosen ignorance because of their commitment to Mickey D's.
You know, there's that denial, but I'm also finding there's a lot of curiosity.
Uh-huh.
Because these kids have seen these ads all their life. But, you know, and I tell them, so you've seen these McDonald's and Burger King ads, and what do they show? They ever show you where the food comes from? They ever show you what you're eating? And the answer always is no. So this is kind of an attempt to go behind the counter, and I think kids are intrigued by things that are deliberately kept hidden from them.
What are some of the new stuff you got in there?
Well, some of it's kind of tragic. I mean, we got the story of a teenager who really loved fast food and became severely overweight, obese, and had gastric bypass surgery, which unfortunately is becoming more common, and even for teenagers. Story of kids on the ranch trying to hold on to the ranch as the ranchers are being crushed by the big meatpacking companies. And just overall, a sense of, you know what you're eating and where it comes from. Just very basic knowledge that you never would have had to teach kids 100 years ago because they were involved in harvesting, preparing, cooking food somehow. But now they have almost no knowledge whatsoever of, you know, where this food comes from.
It's interesting. Like, it's just to get quality food, you do have to do some version of foraging and harvesting.
Yeah.
You have to find the right market to go to. You have to find out where it was made. And also, do you talk about the union busting and the exploitation of teen workers?
You know, I do a bit. I mean, this is aimed at kids 9 to 13, 14 years old. So I can't get into the National Labor Relations Act or anything like that. But try to explain how some kids, for example, at a fast food restaurant in Canada actually formed a union at McDonald's, and how McDonald's tried all kinds of ways to put them out of action. And eventually, when the union of mainly teenagers triumphed, McDonald's shut down the restaurant rather than have to deal with the union.
I think that McDonald's has gone out of their way to respond to the popularity of your book. They're offering salads now and everything. Do you think that had something to do with you?
You know, I don't know if it had anything to do with me or with Morgan Spurlock, or they've been getting a lot of bad publicity. Anytime they offer you something healthy to eat, it's a good thing. I just wonder how sincere it really is. The New York Times did a piece a few weeks ago which said, you know, McDonald's is talking a lot about healthy eating, but they're making most of their money now selling $1 cheeseburgers and fried chicken sandwiches in inner-city communities and heavily targeting the poor and Latino and African-American customers with food that's pretty unhealthy. So I think there's a long way for them to go.
You know, we talk a lot on this show about environmental impact of food production, and my partner here, Jim, it's like his cause. And we pissed off Lori David just by even bringing up the idea of the meat industry's impact on the environment. And Jim wants to ask you a couple questions.
Yeah. Well, yeah, are vegetarians safe? for one thing. I mean, are they subject to the same kind of
horrible ingredients? I never judge a person by their choices, by their food choices.
No, not that way. I mean, are they subject to the same kind of horrible patterns of ingredients and you know, safety standards? That,
you know, you gotta know what you're eating. It's that basic. Now, in the book, in both books, I talk about the rise of foodborne illnesses that are related to these gigantic livestock operations. And the sad news is you could be a vegan or a vegetarian and get the same kind of food poisoning, especially if you're shaking hands with people who are meat eaters and aren't washing their hands. These things, some of these bugs can spread hand to hand. You don't even have to eat the food. And there have been outbreaks of bad E. coli connected to produce, and it's not because the lettuce has this E. coli. It's because it's runoff from these factory farms that are just, you know, really tainted sometimes and have too much waste material at the factory farms that goes into the fields.
And the fertilizers.
Into the fertilizers. It's basically all coming from the cattle manure.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because Jim and I never touch each other. And
well,
now,
just wash your hands frequently whenever you do.
Because I am known to eat a little meat, and I remember talking to you a couple of times about the difficulty of staying away from McDonald's fries at times. And in terms of I hate to get into this, but I have to, and I know it's going to be...
I mean, you're in California. There's In-N-Out Burger. I don't know why you need to get McDonald's fries.
Yeah, I don't. I never go to McDonald's, actually. I was just... I remember talking to you about it, and I asked you about going to McDonald's, and you said the fries are still pretty good.
You know, based on taste, the fries are pretty good. But it's remarkable if you fry potatoes the right way and put salt on them, they taste pretty good at other places, too.
And, yeah, most things fried are good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and In-N-Out Burger certainly has good fries. But let's do a little Mad Cow update, Eric, can you? I mean, like, I'm under the belief, and I hate to bring this up, but I've talked to you about it before, is that that there's a cover-up and that the possibility of it being in our food system is high.
You know, it's definitely in our food system. I just don't know how bad it is and how much of a threat it poses. And anyone who tells you they know really doesn't. I did a phone-in interview the other day on a show, and the chief mad cow specialist from the USDA was on the line. His name is Ron DeHaven, and he made the argument that testing for mad cow disease in the United States would actually make the meat less safe. And I think George Orwell would have loved to hear this. There's a meatpacking company named Creekstone that wants to test all of its cattle for mad cow disease. The USDA won't let them. The argument is the meat will be less safe. So I was asking, well, how will the meat be less safe if you're testing for mad cow? He said, if we test for mad cow, it'll encourage people to eat the brains and the organ meats, and that's where they might get mad cow disease. I don't think there's going to be an epidemic of people rushing out to eat cattle brain if they start testing for mad cow.
That's the first thought I had, is like, hey, if those cows are safe, make me a cow brain milkshake right away.
Yeah, I know. I have no idea if it's a big problem, but to be prudent, you would think we should be testing the meat in the United States.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the scary facts that you have in this new book that I think is going to be very effective with young people is how many cows could be involved in any one patty of beef.
Yeah.
How many?
It's not necessarily dangerous. It's just kind of unpleasant.
It's creepy.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of different pieces of different cattle.
Could be in one hamburger.
In one fast food hamburger. And if you bought a hamburger 30 years ago, it probably came from a little butcher shop or a little processing plant, and it was scraps of meat from one cow or one steer. And now they make them in these enormous factories, thousands of cattle being ground up together. And if one of those cattle was sick or had some kind of bad bug, the odds are much larger you may encounter some bad pathogen you don't want to be eating.
And what about just the karmic idea of having, you know, literally herds of cattle plowing through your intestines?
It's just unappealing.
I'll say. So also, Eric, let's talk a little bit about some of the other, you know, tremendous liabilities of ingesting fast food in terms of the environment, in terms of health, because they are, in the book, what are some of the other things that you point out to the kids?
Well, we were talking about the industrialization of livestock, and you know, what your listeners need to know and what kids need to know is human beings have been eating meat for thousands of years, but they have never eaten meat that's produced this way or processed this way. I mean, we have feedlots in the United States that one feedlot will have 100,000 cattle in it, living in one another's filth. And this is very recent, the last 25 to 30 years. It creates enormous amounts of waste. And in the book, we have a picture of a mountain of manure at a feedlot with 4 million pounds of manure that caught fire, because, you know, it gives off methane gas, and it accidentally caught fire. It took them months to put it out.
Oh, that's
now,
this manure,
you know, gets into waterways. It's one of the leading causes of water pollution in the United States. Animals were not meant to live this way, and never have in history ever lived the way that they're eating, that they're living at these factory farms today.
That was the famous smoking poop pile, wasn't it?
It was it's a photograph of 4 million pounds of burning poop.
And it spontaneously combusted,
it's
right?
It spontaneously combusted because when you dump that much manure together, it heats up and creates methane. We all know that smell, but in large amounts, it's explosive. And this stuff caught on fire, and they couldn't put it out for months. Now, that's the kind of weird stuff that's happening at a factory farm near you.
Now, do you want to talk for a couple more minutes about some of the... You know what? Why don't we hang on? Why don't we do one more segment with you? And can you hang on?
Sure.
All right. Thanks, Eric Schlosser. We'll be right back with Eric Schlosser.
And now he gets most of his news from squirrels. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
They're very well-informed, intelligent squirrels.
Very frisky, too.
That live in my yard. On the phone with us, the author of Fast Food Nation and the new book, Chew on This, Everything You Didn't Want to Know About Fast Food. Eric Schwasser has decided to buzzkill the 10 to 13 year olds of this country and have them rethink one of the things that is probably one of the more prominent elements of their life, which is fast food. And I didn't know some of this stuff, Eric, about these fast food facts that I was given with the package for your book. That one out of every five public schools in the United States now serves brand name fast food?
That's right. And, you know, the industry talks a great deal about parental responsibility. And then they deliberately market and sell their food in schools where parents aren't present. They know that kids form their eating habits really young, and they want to be, they want their brand really popular with kids. So huge marketing efforts in schools. There are some schools that there'll be McDonald's food one day, Pizza Hut the next day, another fast food chain the next day.
That should be illegal.
Well,
and that should be like church and state, the separation
of
fast food and school.
There was this agreement signed last week between former President Bill Clinton,
right,
the current governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, and the soda companies, in which the soda companies agreed not to sell sugary, unhealthy drinks in schools anymore. And I think the next step will be getting the same sort of agreement from McDonald's and Burger King and all the fast food chains who are aggressively moving into the schools. I mean, they shouldn't be selling unhealthy food to kids in schools. It's that simple.
Our tax dollars are subsidizing McDonald's and Pizza Hut.
Well, you know, if we paid a little more for education and communities were willing to spend a little more on education, then the schools wouldn't feel under the pressure to invite these companies in. But the companies are there, and I could be persuaded it's fine for them to be there as long as they're selling really good, healthy food, which they're not at the moment.
And this is interesting, too. If a child is obese by the age of 13, he's more than a 90% chance that he or she will be overweight as a 35-year adult.
It's absolutely tragic, and that's one of the reasons that this book exists. If kids develop really bad eating habits and become overweight and obese early, it becomes very, very difficult and often impossible for them to lose the weight later on. Their metabolism may change in a way, and their natural set point may change in a way, that their body is always going to want to be big. They may develop fat cells, which you can never get rid of. So the key is to prevent children from becoming obese and not to deal with the problem once it's too late or try to deal with it.
So there's literally muscle memory. There's fat memory in a way.
There is, and you know, the obese people have like 7 to 8 times as many fat cells as healthy normal weight people, and those fat cells may empty out and then refill, and it just becomes a cycle of desperately trying to lose weight once you become that big. You really want to prevent kids from becoming obese.
So, what do you suggest to parents and to kids who are doing this, you know, really, you know, out of convenience and for economic reasons, probably more so convenience?
Yeah.
It just seems that I mean, there is healthy food available, but it's not as easy to come by in some of these lower class neighborhoods, and it's overpriced. I mean,
it's tough, and I mean, the title of this new book says it all. Chew on this.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Think before you just follow your impulse and buy this food. What's tragic is that the U.S. government is hugely subsidizing all kinds of unhealthy foods through cheap corn that becomes cheap animal feed, becomes cheap meat, cheap corn sweeteners, cheap soda. And yet the foods that people really need to be eating, like fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, get no direct subsidies at all. So we've got to take away the government supports for this unhealthy food and really help bring, you know, the healthier food to the people who need it, the people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. If you look at who is obese and who is unhealthy in the United States, they're the children of the poor and poor people, and they're the people who can least afford
anything.
This diet.
Anything. They can't afford anything. They get
right.
sick. They can't afford health care because they don't have health care. They go broke. They can't get bankruptcy anymore. The agenda of this administration, this idea, this sort of adapt or die sensibility, it just really, I think, what needs these people to know is that they are as disposable as that Happy Meal box.
And also these companies, in the sense of these companies talk about personal responsibility, they talk about parental responsibility, and they should think a little more about corporate responsibility. The practice of targeting low-income communities with this food is very similar to the practice that the tobacco company used as upper middle class and well-educated people began to quit smoking because of the health effects. The tobacco industry really targeted low-income communities and developing nations, which is exactly what the fast food chains are doing. And I think if they're going to sell food this aggressively to the poor, or if they're going to aggressively target children, they should have a product that isn't going to make people unhealthy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Eric Schlosser. I really appreciate it. The new
thank
book
you.
Is Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Foods. Have a great day, and next time you're in L.A., maybe we'll get you in here.
Would love to.
Okay, Eric, take care.
Thank you.
That's some sobering information for the kids. And tomorrow, Jim, if everything works well, we're going to have Michael Pollan in here. He's the author of The Omnivore Dilemma. In terms of, you know, a practical approach to perhaps maintaining a little meat and a little fish and a little vegetable
yes.
in your diet without depleting the environment and everything. Actor Richard Grant has directed a film called Wawa. We're going to talk to him next, so hang out for that.
He's ignoring charges of torture. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
Very
excited. Very excited to have our next guest on the phone. As an actor, Richard Grant has been in a few of my favorite films. He has a cult following for his roles in How to Get Ahead in Advertising and Whitnail and I. He was in Bob Altman's The Player and Gosford Park. Now Richard Grant has made his directorial debut with Wawa. It premiered in the at the New York Tribeca Film Festival, I guess last week, and opens in New York and L.A. May 12th. It is a film about a family assigned to live in Swaziland during the last stages of the British Empire's presence in the country. The story revolves around a boy named Ralph, his drunken father, played by Gabriel Byrne, his philandering mother, played by Miranda Richardson, and his American stepmother, played by Emily Watson, all brilliantly. It's a sweet movie. Welcome to the show, Richard Grant.
Thank you very much, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. I really enjoyed your film. I thought it was very touching. Seemed very personal to me.
Thank you.
And before we get into that, I mean, what is the? See, I guess I'm just sort of a dumb American in the fact. What is the background of the British in Swaziland?
It was a British colonial protectorate for the last from the turn of the last century up until 1968. And my father was there as a colonial administrator, running the education department.
So this is a really autobiographical movie.
Oh, yeah, everything that happened, happened.
Yeah, you could definitely tell that because there are certain things that happen in the film that there's no way they could be made up.
I mean,
there's just certain character points that were just so unique that if a writer did, you know, just conceive of them fictionally, he would have to be a genius. the puppets and all kinds and the nervous tick that the kid had. And it was just, it was a really a beautiful movie. Did you shoot most of it in Africa?
I shot absolutely everything in Swaziland where all the where the actual events happened, in most of the places, you know, where everything took place. And a lot of the extras were people that I knew from when I was growing up there. So it really is as authentic as possible without making a docudrama of what it was like to live there, the sort of last gasp of empire.
So when you were there, did it all come sort of rushing back to you? Was it emotional for you to be back?
It was. I mean, the writing of the script was sort of the catharsis of it, if you like. But and going back and recreating these events with this amazingly talented bunch of actors, you know, Gabriel Byrne, Emily Watson, Julie Waters, Miranda Richardson was pretty extraordinary. So it was a kind of deja vu experience to go back and see them in the costumes of the period, in the places where this stuff all happened.
Did you see any childhood friends?
Oh yeah, plenty. Yeah, they're all in the movie as extras.
Oh, really?
Now, of course, yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. And in terms of directing as opposed to acting, you're a very unique actor, and you definitely have a way of doing things. Now, what was it like to actually direct such a talented bunch, and was there tension or any sort of friction on the set?
Well, you'd have to ask the actors, but I mean, the actors, to my face, said that they had the best time they'd ever had on a movie. So, you know, I think that's because it was a low-budget movie, $7 million, shooting in a country that had never had a movie made there before, with the first-time writer, director, me, it then, you know, everybody sort of really pulled out all the stops and supported it, and we had an extraordinary time out there. It was, you know, life-changing for everybody, not just me.
So in terms of, like, one thing I didn't see a lot of in the film, and I don't know if it was present when you were there, or there was not a real sense of racial tension.
No, that was what was unique about Swaziland. It was called the Switzerland of Africa, geographically and politically, because it was invited colonialism, if you like, because the king requested of Queen Victoria at the turn of the last century to come and form a colonial protectorate over the country so that they weren't taken over by the gold-seeking South Africans next door. So it, as a result, it was the hand back of independence, or the return to it, was very peaceable and didn't have any riots or revolution or coup or dictatorship or any of the stuff that's so blighted the rest of Africa. So it's a very, you know, true reflection of how that was.
Well, that it's very unique because as an American or just as a moviegoer, you're so programmed to feel that type of tension. And
yeah.
And because I didn't know the history, it just wasn't present at all. And I found it fascinating.
Oh, good. Well, that's pretty, you know, accurate to my experience of growing up there. And certainly when I go back there, it just feels as laid back and easygoing as ever it was when I was there.
And it was interesting to me also in the film that the British class element, that there were certain different class levels within the community, that even those broke down a bit just by virtue of the humanity of the individuals involved. And
exactly.
That was, yeah, that was very warm as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and in terms of in terms of shooting the film, now I guess I'm sort of fascinated with Emily Watson, and I have, I guess, a general question for you. Do you find that, because she seemed to avoid this, but it seems that sometimes when English actors do Americans, they get a little nasally. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, but she did a great job. I mean, I obviously tried to cast an American star actress to play that part, and they all turned me down.
No, she didn't do nasally at all. I thought she was great. Was it? And if you don't mind me asking, I'm Jewish. Was that character Jewish?
Yes, she was.
Oh, good. Because she really played that way. I felt a very strong identification to something from my past.
Oh, good. Oh, that's excellent. Well, I'll tell Emily, because she's in New Zealand at the moment, and my wife, who's a Scottish Gentile, is the Henry Higgins of dialect coaching in England.
Oh, yeah?
And she was the person who coached Emily, so I take that as great great success on both their parts.
Oh, it really came off well. How was the response at the Tribeca Festival? How have people...
Absolutely amazing.
And what are the details about its opening? It opens on the 12th here?
It opens, this Friday, May 12th, and in key cities, and then I think it'll go wider towards the end of the month.
Now, as a director and as a person who this film is about, if you could just give me a little trajectory of how you would describe the film so people who are listening will know.
Hopefully a comedy stroke dramedy drama about coming of age at the end of an age and the last gasp of empire in Southeast Africa, where it's all set. And I suppose it's it deals with everything from adultery, divorce, addiction, death of a loved one, first love, lost love, unrequited love, newfound love, everlasting love, all of those things. So, you know, it's the full bang shoot of what it's like to be in a family, and the public show and the private face of what actually goes on behind closed doors doesn't seem to matter which sort of culture you come from. This stuff all goes on, and that's what I've focused on.
And I think what's also fascinating is when you remove that the sort of British sensibility and place it as someplace far out as that, it really, you know, the great thing about the movie is a lot of it just sort of broke down, and you were really able, for the first time that I can remember, to see that type of British community in a very human way.
Oh, good. Well, yeah. I take that as a compliment. Thank you very much indeed.
You bet. What else? You got something going now? Are you just selling the movie? Are you acting in something?
Selling the movie, but I've also just acted in a movie with Reese Witherspoon, Christina Ricci, and Catherine O'Hara called Penelope, an American movie, which will come out here at the end of the year.
Catherine O'Hara is hilarious.
yeah, hilarious. We play husband and wife, and you know, I've admired her for so long from all the Christopher Guest movies. So that was a real thrill to play with her.
And then a personal question for my satisfaction: working with Robert Altman, is that intimidating?
It was the first time, but I worked with him 3 times, and he is such a collaborative, open, all-inclusive human being, and so welcomes actors' improvisations and ideas. And he wants everybody to have a good time, and everybody's basically paid the same and treated as democratically as it's possible to be on a movie. You couldn't have a better time. And so, you know, the fact that I worked with him 3 times is an absolute highlight of my career.
I'm trying to remember that. I'm trying to remember the third one. You did The Player, Gosford Park.
I did The Player, Ready to Wear, and Gosford Park.
Oh, Ready to Wear. I didn't see that one. I got to go see that one. And what about directors in terms of, as an actor, who are you dying to work with and would like that opportunity to do so?
Well, I'll send you the self-addressed envelope with a list of people that you can, you know, from Tarantino, Spielberg, Wes Anderson, P.T. Anderson, Up, Down, and Sideways. You know, I'm available.
Okay. Well, this is going to be on in L.A., so maybe somebody will hear it.
Okay, Mark.
Well, thank you very much, Richard Grant. The movie is Wawa, and great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
You take care.
Okay, and you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That was a... it's interesting with these movies, because I went online on IMDb to look at people's comments, and I don't know what the hell people expect out of films. This was an incredibly personal film that could be nothing but true, and for me, whatever you might have thought was trite in it, emotionally trite, or whatever was not satisfying to you, it was certainly a window into a world that I would never have imagined, because you're looking at a world, it's the late 60s, so you have a lot of the fashions and a lot of the kind of the culture is changing in terms of their views of sex and in terms of the Americanization of that kind of mod thing. Mm-hmm. And it's in the middle of Swaziland, and it's this classist British community, and you just see it sort of disintegrate in the face of all this humanity. It's a very sweet movie, and I recommend it highly. I did, and also he's like. He's an awesome actor. Look, I can't. You know what, folks? In a second, I am going to do my short order news, of course, and also I am going to right now. I'm going to tell you, Jim.
Yes.
I'm not going to go see Mission Impossible 3. That's one thing I'm going to tell you. Another thing I'm going to tell you.
Great. Now I got to go alone.
You want to go? If I'll go with you, you want to go with the girls?
Sure.
Because my wife likes movies like that. And I, you know what, we got to call my dad later this week. We got to do a Dr. Marin's movie reviews, because I'm sure he's seen it. He's chomping at the bit to do movie reviews. He'll literally call me and he's like, "I just want to get you up to speed on a couple of films." I'm like, "Why don't you hold on to it, Pops?"
You know, it'd be fun to have your dad review old movies that he never saw.
Sometimes I'll just drop. You've seen me do that, where I'll mention a movie that doesn't exist, and just to watch my dad go, "Oh, yeah, I didn't see that one."
Yeah, no, I find that very cruel.
Are you going to send your no? Look, I have to get my mom something for Mother's Day this time. I screwed up last week. It was her birthday. And when they say they don't want anything, they don't mean it. Do you understand? When they say they don't want anything, they don't mean it. Short order news in a second.
Stay where you are, because I'm looking at you through the bathroom window. Oh, and Mark Maron's short order news is coming up next. And now, this was written by a 10-year-old in China, Mark Maron.
Man, Jim's outsourcing, because you're painting now. And
Don't have time. You know, it takes me a long time to put something down on canvas.
My mother was a painter until she gave it up, so I grew up with paintings everywhere.
Yes. Good paintings? Nice paintings?
She did okay. She was a very... You know what she really excelled at was photography, I thought, and silk screening, and drawing was good. Her paintings were interesting, but because of her, I was brought up with a lot of trips to MoMA and the Whitney, and we had relatives when I was growing up in New Mexico. My grandmother lived in the East, so every time we'd go back east, there'd be the constant, you know, spending time at all the museums and galleries.
She would paint, like, kind of modernist things, huh?
I think that it was pretty figurative. It wasn't too abstract. No. What are you? I picture you more realist painter.
Yeah, yeah.
You do the realist thing?
Yeah. I'm not good enough to do modern painting yet. I think you got to start out realism and then go off into what.
Yeah, I believe that's true. I believe that you cannot be an iconoclast or a radical until you know what you're radicalizing.
But I prefer realism. I prefer, you know, the Netherlandish panel painting. This is really interesting to a lot of, you know, about five people.
No, this might raise your stock with some of our listeners.
Really?
Yeah. They're like, oh,
raise it any more than it already is.
Jim isn't just this weird progressive crank who, you know, puts everybody on the spot about meat. He's got this other side where he paints realistic pictures of things. What are you painting? The slaughterhouse?
I'm finishing a small. I'm finishing a small still life of an artichoke and a yellow squash.
Are you really?
Yes.
That's great.
Shut up.
I know. I'm not mocking you. You're talking. Look, I went to the Green Market today after yoga. Not today, on Sunday. I got up early. I went to my third yoga class in a week, and everything's locked down. You know, I'm feeling good. My core is tight. And I go to the Green Market, and I bought an artichoke at the Green Market that still had a stem on it. Like, they sell them. There's one place that sells them like they're flowers. They look like dinosaur flowers, artichokes, don't they?
Yeah.
They're like prehistoric flowers. And I cut it off, and I stuck it in water just to keep it all tight and fresh. And I'm going to cook it up. I'm an artichoke fan. I got nothing against artichokes, and I'm certainly not good. Nothing impresses me more than people that can paint, Jim. And I got to be honest with you. My buddy Phil Bauer is a great painter. I bought one of his works. I've been a patron of the arts. My buddy Charlie Miller, if you go to sixmoremiles.com, you can see his series of Jewish boxers. He's a realist painter as well. He's done some great portraits of a lot of the decadent rock and roll characters. He did the cover of my book, The Jerusalem Syndrome.
Okay. Yeah.
Charles Miller. I think it's sixmoremiles.com. But and also, I think, jewishboxers.com. Why am I just plugging Charlie
Speaking
Miller?
Speaking of Jewish boxers, that was probably the worst Jewish accent I've ever heard in my life.
That Bruce did earlier?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bruce has got a lot of work to do.
I mean, what the hell was that? I mean, that was just, like, disturbingly. I don't even. Was that Irish? That was, like, approaching Italian, Irish, Jewish.
It was a mixture of things. It was, it was the Bruce Cherry hybrid. You always get a little cherry underneath it all. What do we got going tomorrow? I seem to have lost all of the papers that are important to me, Jim. Everything that I had in front of me has gone away, and it's very disturbing.
Tomorrow we'll have Don Rickles.
No, tomorrow.
Liberace.
No, tomorrow we have a good show tomorrow. Keep talking, Jim.
And the Gold Diggers.
Yeah, good. Yeah, keep talking. Who else?
Tony Curtis.
Yes, that's right. Tony Curtis will be here. No, wait, I found the paper. Michael Pollan, the guy who we talked about earlier, another guy about food, but I think I think his angle is to bring back the small farm, to bring back a community connection with the food they put in their body.
Yeah, I'd like to ask him about that.
What do you got a problem with that too?
I don't know, but you know, I would like to ask him about that.
Wait, let me ask
There's
you a
something
question.
Wrong with my intonation. You know, I have incorrect intonation lately. I can't control my intonation. Okay. I should have said, you know, I'd really like to ask him about that instead of, yeah, I'd like to ask him about that.
That's a weird. That would be a weird disease to have.
Yeah.
Like,
how are you? Bad intonation.
I'm sorry.
Syndrome.
Yeah.
I'm gonna write that one down.
How are you? I can't even. It's hard for me to even.
No, I want to ask him about that. About you know how much meat he thinks people can eat and be live healthy.
But would you have a problem with that if they got rid of agribusiness as it was and it was illegal and all you could have was small community farms and you could only ship food?
That'd be great.
You could only ship food like 50 miles outside of where it's made.
Well, I don't know about that. You know, some people you can't get an artichoke in parts of Manhattan. You know, you can't get strawberries in Manhattan. That's one of the reasons I left. That and
strawberries.
I was driven out.
Yeah, strawberries, artichokes, and the fact that you were pushed out, fired. Hey, here we go. A lot happened in the world today, and we don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. So here's the second edition of Mark Maron Show's Short Order News. The leader of Iran has written to President Bush, proposing new solutions to their differences in the first letter. Wow. Talk about intonation problems. The leader of Iran has written to President Bush proposing new solutions to their differences in the first letter from an Iranian head of state to an American president in 27 years. The letter is seen as one of hope, beginning with the familiar words, "Are you there, George? It's me, Mahmoud." The Senate is expressing serious concerns about General Michael Hayden, President Bush's expected choice to replace Porter Goss as head of the CIA. Some senators feel having a general run the CIA could create the impression that the agency is under the control of the Pentagon, while others praise the choice, saying it will streamline the fake intelligence, lie, then cover up process. Okay. China has manufactured its first personal robot that can provide services at home and, among other skills, log onto the internet and tell its owners the news and weather. Standing at nearly 3 feet, the robot is able to navigate obstacles at ease, though it still can't get around the fact it makes even less than those Nike workers down the street. And that's the short order news for tonight. I have a rumor here, too, that we will also be speaking to Ari Berman. He's a political writer for The Nation. He's their Washington correspondent. And there's an outside chance that Patton Oswalt will be in studio tomorrow because he lives down the street. And I've been telling him to come back and talk to me.
He's a TV star, kind of.
Yeah, he is. Look, I am not going to resent anymore. I'm not going to be a player hater of people that I like. And, you know, Patton's a funny guy. He's had a good run on King of Queens. He's got to make a nice chunk of change for that. He does a little.
You applaud that.
Well, whatever. You know, I mean.
You encourage that. You like it.
I don't know. I've kind of busted him about it before, but a lot of people love the King of Queens, and they love his character on it, so he's bringing joy to people, despite the fact that I may not like the show. Man, I am being too diplomatic. You know, whatever. You know, it's a nice check. He's doing all right.
He's performing a service for Americans.
He's got a pool and a nice grill. He's got a grill.
He's got a great O'Keefe and Merritt antique stove.
He does.
Yes.
It's a nice stove.
And you don't?
No, I don't. But I just built a nice gate. I don't have a pool. You can't put a pool on a hill. Ah, we gotta go. I'm gonna be mean from here on out. I'm not gonna give anyone any more breaks. That's the kind of radio I'm gonna do. Good night, sheeple. I want some chocolate.